The Maze of Mauled Webb, Clark Ashton Smith. By the light of the four small waning moons of Zykarth, Tiglari had crossed that bottomless swamp wherein no reptile dwelt and no dragon descended, but where the pitch-black ooze was alive with incessant heavings. He had not cared to use the high causerie of Corundum that spanned the fen, and had threaded his way with much peril from isle to sedgy isle that shuddered gelatinously beneath him. When he reached the solid shore and the shelter of the palm-tall rushes, he did not approach the porphyry stairs that wound skyward through giddy chasms and along glassy scarps to the house of Mauled Webb. The causey and the stairs were guarded by the silent, colossal automatons of Mauled Webb, whose arms ended in long crescent blades of tempered steel, which were raised in implacable scything against any who came thither without their master's permission. Tiglari's naked body was smeared with the juice of a plant repugnant to all the fauna of Zykarth. By virtue of this, he hoped to pass unharmed the ferocious ape-like creatures that roamed at will through the tyrant's cliff-hung gardens. He carried a coil of woven root fiber, strong and light, and weighted with a brazen ball for use in climbing the mesa. At his side, in a sheath of chimera skin, he wore a needle-sharp knife that had been dipped in the poison of winged vipers. Many before Tiglari, with the same noble dream of tyrannicide, had attempted to cross the fen and scale the scarps, but none had returned, and the fate of such as had won to the palace of Mauled Webb was a much-disputed problem. But Tiglari, the skilled jungle hunter, was undeterred by the hideous dubieties before him. That escalade would have been an improbable feat by the full light of the three suns of Zykarth. With eyes keen as those of some night-flying pterodactyl, Tiglari hurled his weighted coil about narrow coignes and salients. He climbed with simian ease from foothold to foothold, and at length he gained a little buttress beneath the last cliff. From this vantage it was easy to fling his rope round a crooked tree that leaned gulfward, with scimitar-like foliage from the gardens. Evading the sharp, semi-metallic leaves that slashed downward as the tree bent limberly with his weight, he stood, stooping warily, on the fearsome and fabled mesa. Here, it was said, with no human aid, the half-demonic sorcerer had carved a mountain's pinnacles into walls, domes, and turrets, and had leveled the rest of the mountain to a flat space about them. This space he had covered with loamy soil, produced by magic, and therein he had planted curious, baneful trees from outlying worlds, together with flowers that might have been those of some exuberant hell. Little enough was known of these gardens, but the flora that grew upon the northern, southern, and western sides of the palace was believed to be less deadly than that which faced the dawning of the three suns. Much of this latter vegetation, according to myth, had been trained and topiarized in the form of a labyrinth, balefully ingenuous, that concealed atrocious traps and unknown dooms. Mindful of this labyrinth, Tiglari had approached the place on the side toward the sunset. Breathless from his climb, he crouched in the garden shadows. About him, heavy-hooded blossoms leaned in venomous languor, or fawned with open mouths that exhaled a narcotic perfume, or diffused a pollen of madness. Anomalous, multiform, with silhouettes that curled the blood or touched the mind with nightmare, the trees of Mauled Webb appeared to gather and conspire against him. Some rose with the sinuous towering of plumed pythons, of egreted dragons. Others crouched with radiating limbs like the hairy members of giant spiders. They seemed to close in upon Tiglari. They waved their frightful darts of thorn, their scythe-like leaves. They blotted the four moons with webs of arabesque menace. With endless caution, the hunter made his way forward, seeking a rift in the monstrous hedge. His faculties, ever alert, were quickened still more by fear and hatred. The fear was not for himself, but for the girl Athli. his beloved, and the fairest of his tribe, who had gone up alone that evening by the causerie of Corundum and the porphyry stairs at the summons of Waldweb. His hatred was that of an outraged lover for the all-powerful, all-dreaded tyrant, whom no man had ever seen, and from whose abode no woman ever came back, who spoke with an iron voice audible in far cities or outmost jungles, who punished the disobedient with a doom of falling fire swifter than the thunderstone. Waldweb had taken ever the fairest from among the maidens of the planet Zakarth, and no mansion of the walled towns or outland cave was exempt from his scrutiny. He had chosen no less than 50 girls during the period of his tyranny, and these, forsaking their lovers and kinfolks voluntarily, lest the wrath of Waldweb should descend upon them, had gone one by one to the mountain citadel, and were lost behind its cryptic walls. There, as the Oledesks of the aged sorcerer, they were supposed to dwell in halls that multiplied their beauty with 1,000 mirrors, and were said to have for servants women of brass and men of iron. Tiglari had poured before Afli his uncouth adoration and the spoils of the chase, but having many rivals, was unsure of her favor. Cool as a river lily, she had accepted impartially his worship and that of the others, among whom the warrior Mokar was perhaps the most formidable. Returning from the hunt, Tiglari had found the tribe in lamentation, and, learning that Afli had departed to the harem of Maldweb, was swift to follow. He had not told his intention to anyone, since the ears of Maldweb were everywhere, and he did not know whether Mokar or any of the others had preceded him in his desperate errantry. But it was not unlikely that Mokar had already dared the obscure and hideous perils of the mountain. The thought of this was enough to drive Tiglari forward with a rash disregard for the clutching foliations and reptile flowers. He came to a gap in the horrible grove and saw the saffron lights from the sorcerer's windows. The lights were vigilant as dragon's eyes, and appeared to regard him with an evil awareness. But Tiglari leapt toward them, across the gap, and heard the clash of sabered leaves meeting behind him. Before him was an open lawn, covered with a queer grass that squirmed like innumerable worms underneath his feet. He did not care to linger upon that lawn. There were no footmarks in the grass, but nearing the palace portico, he saw a coil of thin rope that someone had flung aside, and surmised that Mokar had preceded him. There were paths of mottled marble about the palace, and fountains that played from the throats of carven monsters. The open portals were unguarded, and the whole building was still as a mausoleum lit by windless lamps. Tiglari, however, mistrusted this appearance of quietude and slumber, and followed the bordering paths for some distance before daring to approach nearer to the palace. Certain large and shadowy animals, which he took for the apish monsters of Waldweb, went by him in the gloom. Some of them ran in four-footed fashion, while others maintained the half-erect posture of anthropoids. But all were hairy and uncouth. They did not offer to molest Tiglari, but whining dismally, they slunk away as if to avoid him. By this token he knew that they were actual beasts, and could not abide the odor with which he had smeared his limbs and torso. At length he came to a lampless, column-crowned portico, and gliding silently as a jungle snake, he entered the mysterious house of Waldweb. A door stood open behind the dark pillars, and beyond the door he discerned the dim reaches of an empty hall. Tiglari went in with redoubled caution, and began to follow the arrased wall. The place was full of unknown perfumes, languorous and somnolent, a subtle reek of censers in hidden alcoves of love. He did not like the perfumes, and the silence troubled him more and more. It seemed to him that the darkness was thick with unheard breathings, was alive with invisible movements. Slowly, like the opening of great yellow eyes, yellow flames arose in lamps of copper along the wall. Tiglari hid himself behind an arras, and, peering forth presently, he saw that the hall was still deserted. Finally, he dared to resume his progress. All around him, the rich hangings, broidered with purple men and blue women on a field of blood, appeared to stir with uneasy life in a wind he could not feel. But there was no sign of the presence of Wald Webb, or his metal servitudes and human odalisques. The doors on either side of the hall, with cunningly mated valves of ebony and ivory, were all closed. At the far end, Tiglari saw a thin rift of light in a somber double arras. Parting the arras very slowly, he peered through into a huge, brilliantly lit chamber that seemed to be the harem of Mauld Webb, peopled with all the girls that the enchanter had summoned to his dwelling. It seemed, in fact, that there were hundreds leaning or lying on ornate couches, or standing in attitudes of languor or terror. Tiglari discerned in the throng the women of Zayn, whose flesh is whiter than desert salt, the slim girls of Euthymai, who are molded from breathing, palpitating jet, the queenly topaz girls of equatorial Zala, and the small women of Lip, who have the tones of newly greening bronze. But among them all, he could not find the lotus-like beauty of Athli. Much he marveled at the number of the women and the perfect stillness with which they maintained their various postures. They were like goddesses that slept in some enchanted hall of eternity. Tiglari, the intrepid hunter, was awed and frightened. These women, if indeed they were women and not mere statues, were surely the thralls of a death-like spell. Here, indeed, was proof of the sorcery of Mauld Webb. However, if Tiglari were to continue his search, he must traverse that enchanted chamber. Feeling that a marble sleep might descend upon him at the crossing of the sill, he went in with held breath and furtive, leopard-like paces. About him, the women preserved their eternal stillness. Each, it seemed, had been overcome by the spell at the instant of some particular emotion, whether of fear, wonder, curiosity, vanity, weariness, anger, or voluptuousness. Their number was fewer than he had supposed, and the room itself was smaller, but metal mirrors paneling the walls had created an illusion of multitude and immensity. At the farther end, he parted a second double arras and peered into a twilight chamber illuminated dimly by two censers that gave forth a parti-colored glow. The censers stood on tripods, facing each other. Between them, beneath a canopy of some dark and smoldering stuff, with hinges braided like women's hair, was a couch of night-deep purples bordered with silver birds that fought against golden snakes. On the couch, in somber garments, a man reclined as if weary or asleep. The man's face was dim with ever-wavering shadows, but it did not occur to Tiglari that this was any other than the redoubtable tyrant whom he had come to slay. He knew that this was Mauld Webb, whom no man had seen in the flesh, but whose power was manifest to all, the occult, omniscient ruler of Zykarpf, the suzerain of the three suns and of all their planets and moons. Like ghostly sentinels, the symbols of the grandeur of Mauld Webb, the images of his frightful empire, rose up to confront Tiglari. But the thought of Athli was a red mist that blotted all. He forgot his eerie terrors, his awe of that wizard palace, the rage of the bereaved lover, the bloodthirst of the cunning hunter awoke within him. He neared the unconscious sorcerer, and his hand tightened on the hilt of the needle-sharp knife that had been dipped in viper venom. The man before him lay with closed eyes and a cryptic weariness on his mouth and eyelids. He seemed to meditate rather than sleep, like one who wanders in a maze of distant memories or profound reveries. About him the walls were draped with funereal hangings, darkly figured. Above him the twin censers wrought a cloudy glow, and diffused throughout the room their drowsy myrrh, which made Tiglari's senses swim with a strange dimness. Crouching, tiger-wise, he made ready for the stroke. Then, mastering the subtle vertigo of the perfume, he rose up, and his arm, with the darting movement of some heavy but supple adder, struck fiercely at the tyrant's heart. It was as if he tried to pierce a wall of stone. In mid-air, before and above the recumbent enchanter, the knife clashed on some unseen, impenetrable substance, and the point broke off and tinkled on the floor at Tiglari's feet. Uncomprehendingly, baffled, he peered at the being whom he had sought to slay. Waldweb had not stirred nor opened his eyes, but his look of enigmatic weariness was somehow touched with a faint and cruel amusement. Tiglari put out his hand to verify a curious notion that had occurred to him. Even as he had suspected, there was no couch or canopy between the censers, only a vertical, unbroken, highly polished surface in which the couch and its occupant were apparently reflected. But, to his further mystification, he himself was not visible in the mirror. He whirled about, thinking that Mualdweb must be somewhere in the room. Even as he turned, the funereal draperies rushed back with a silken, evil whispering from the walls, as if drawn by unseen hands. The chamber leapt into sudden glaring light. The walls appeared to recede illuminably, and naked giants, whose umber-brown limbs and torsos glistened as if smeared with ointment, stood in menacing postures on every side. Their eyes glowered like those of jungle creatures, and each of them held an enormous knife from which the point had been broken. This, thought Tiglari, was a fearsome thaumaturgy, and he crouched down, wary as a trapped animal, to await the assault of the giants. But these beings, crouching simultaneously, mimicked his every movement. It came to him that what he saw was his own reflection, multiplied in the mirrors. He turned again. The tasseled canopy, the couch of night-dark purples, the reclining dreamer had vanished. Only the censers remained, rearing before a glassy wall that gave back, like the others, the reflection of Tiglari himself. Baffled and terrified, he felt that Mualdweb, the all-seeing, all-potent magician, was playing a game and was deluding him with elaborate mockeries. Rashly indeed had Tiglari pitted his simple brawn and forest craft against a being capable of such demonic artifice. He dared not stir. He scarcely ventured to breathe. The monstrous reflections appeared to watch him like giants guarding a captive pygmy. The light, which streamed as if from hidden lamps in the mirrors, took on a more pitiless and alarming luster. The reaches of the room seemed to deepen, and far away in their shadows he saw the gathering of vapors with human faces that melted and reformed incessantly, and were never twice the same. Ever the weird radiance brightened, ever the mist of faces, like a hell-born smoke, dissolved and relimbed itself behind the immobile giants in the lengthening vistas. How long Tiglari waited he could not tell. The bright, frozen horror of that room was a thing apart from time. Now, in the lit air, a voice began to speak, a voice that was toneless, deliberate, and disembodied. It was faintly contemptuous, a little weary, slightly cruel. It was near to the beating of Tiglari's heart, and yet infinitely far.
"What do you see, Tiglari?"
said the voice.
"Do you think to enter with impunity the palace of Waldweb? Others, many others, with the same intentions, have come before you, but all have paid a price for their temerity."
"I seek the maiden Athli," said Tiglari. "What have you done with her?"
"Athli is very beautiful,"
returned the voice.
"It is the will of Waldweb to make a certain use of her loveliness. The use is not one that should concern a hunter of wild beasts. You are unwise, Tiglari."
"Where is Athli?" persisted the hunter.
"She has gone to find her fate in the labyrinth of Waldweb. Not long ago, the warrior Mokar, who had followed her to my palace, went out at my suggestion to pursue his search amid the threadless windings of that never-to-be-exhausted maze. Go now, Tiglari, and seek her also. There are many mysteries in my labyrinth, and among them, perhaps, is one which you are destined to solve."
A door had opened in the mirror-paneled wall, emerging, as if from the mirrors. Two of the metal slaves of Waldweb had appeared, taller than living men, and gleaming from head to foot with implacable lusters as of burnished swords, they came forward upon Tiglari. The right arm of each was handed with a great sickle. Hastily, the hunter went out through the open door, and heard behind him the surly clash of its meeting valves. The short night of the planet Zikatharp was not yet over, and the moons had all gone down. But Tiglari saw before him the beginning of the fabled maze, illuminated by glowing globular fruit that hang lantern-wise from the arches of foliage. Guided only by their light, he entered the labyrinth. At first it was a place of elfin fantasies. There were quaint paths, pillared with antique trees, latticed with drolly peering faces of extravagant orchids, that led the seeker to hidden, surprising bowers of goblinry. It was as if those outer mazes had been planned wholly to entice and beguile. Then, by vague degrees, it seemed that the designer's mood had darkened, had become more ominous and baleful. The trees that lined the way with their twisted, intertwining boles were lacunes of struggle and torture, lit by enormous fungi that seemed to lift unholy tapers. The path ran downward to eerie pools alight with wreathing witch-fires, or climbed with evilly tilted steps through caverns of close-set leafage that shone like brazen dragon scales. It divided at every turn. The branching multiplied, and skillful though he was in jungle craft, it would have been impossible for Tiglari to retrace his wanderings. He kept on, hoping that chance would somehow lead him to Athli, and many times he called her name aloud, but was answered only by remote, derisive echoes, or by the dolorous howling of some unseen beast. Now he was mounting through arbors of malignant hydra growths that coiled and uncoiled tumultuously about him. The way lightened more and more. The night-shining fruits and blossoms were pale and sickly as the dying tapers of a witch's revel. The earliest of the three suns had risen, and its gamboge yellow beams were filtering in through the frilled and venomous vines.
Far off, and seeming to fall from some hidden height in the maze before him, he heard a chorus of brazen voices that were like articulate bells. He could not distinguish the words, but the accents were those of a solemn announcement, fraught with portentous finality. They ceased, and there was no sound other than the hiss and rustle of swaying plants. It seemed now, as Tuglari went on, that his every step was predestined. He was no longer free to choose his way, for many of the paths were overgrown by things that he did not care to face, and others were blocked by horrid porticulluses of cacti, or ended in pools that teemed with leeches larger than tunies. The second and third suns arose, heightening with their emerald and carmine rays the horrors of the strange web closing ineluctably about him. He climbed on by stairs that reptilian vines had taken, and gradients lined with tossing, clashing aloes. Rarely could he see the reaches below, or the levels toward which he was tending. Somewhere on the blind path he met one of the ape-like animals of Waldweb, a dark, savage creature, sleek and glistening like a wet otter, as if it bathed in one of the pools. It passed him with a hoarse growl, recoiling as the others had done from his repulsively smeared body. But nowhere could he find the maiden Athli, or the warrior Mokare, who had preceded him into the maze. Now he came to a curious little pavement of onyx, oblong and surrounded by enormous flowers, with bronze-like stems and great-leaning bells that might have been the mouths of chamaras yawning to disclose their crimson throats. He stepped forward upon the pavement through a narrow gap in this ciguatar hedge, and stood staring irresolutely at the serried blooms, for here the way seemed to end. The onyx beneath his feet was wet with some unknown sticky fluid. A quick sense of peril stirred within him, and he turned to retrace his steps. At his first movement toward the opening through which he had entered, a long tendril like a wire of bronze recoiled with lightning rapidity from the base of each of the flower stems, and closed about his ankles. He stood trapped and helpless at the center of a taut net. Then, while he struggled impotently, the stems began to lean and tilt toward him, till the red mouths of their blossoms were close about his knees like a circle of fawning monsters. Nearer they came, almost touching him. From their lips a clear, hueless liquid, dripping slowly at first, and then running in little rills, descended on his feet and ankles and shanks. Indescribably, his flesh crawled beneath it. Then there was a passing numbness, then a furious stinging like the bites of innumerable insects. Beneath the crowning heads of the flowers, he saw that his legs had undergone a mysterious and horrifying change. Their natural hairiness had thickened, had assumed a shaggy pile like the fur of apes. The shanks themselves had somehow shortened, and the feet had grown longer, with uncouth, finger-like toes, such as were possessed by the animals of Waldweb. In a frenzy of nameless alarm, he drew his broken-tipped knife and began to slash at the flowers. It was as if he had assailed the armored heads of dragons, or had struck at ringing bells of iron. The blade snapped at the hilt, then the blossoms, lifting hideously, were leaning about his waist, were laving his hips and thighs with their thin, evil slaver. With the senses of one who drowns in nightmare, he heard the startled cry of a woman. Above the tilted flowers, he beheld a strange scene which the hitherto impenetrable maze, parting as if by magic, had revealed. 50 feet away, on the same level as the onyx pavement, there stood an elliptic dais of moon-white stone, at whose center the maiden Athli, emerging from the labyrinth on a raised porphyry walk, had paused in an attitude of wonder. Before her, in the claws of an immense marble lizard, that reared above the dais, a round mirror of steely metal was held upright. Athli, as if fascinated by some strange vision, was peering into the disk. Midway between the pavement and the dais, a row of slender brazen columns rose at broad intervals, topped with graven heads like demonic termini. Dick Laurie would have called out to Athli, but at that moment she took a single step toward the mirror, as if drawn by something that she saw in its depths, and the dull disk seemed to brighten with some internal incandescent flame. The hunter's eyes were blinded by the spiky rays that leaped forth from it for an instant, enveloping and transfixing the maiden. When the dimness cleared away in whirling blots of color, he saw that Athli, in a pose of statuesque rigidity, was still regarding the mirror with startled eyes. She had not moved. The wonder was frozen on her face, and it came to Teglari that she was like the women who slept an enchanted slumber in the harem of Maldweb. Even as this thought occurred to him, he heard a ringing chorus of metallic voices that seemed to emanate from the graven demon heads of the columns.
"The maiden Athli,"
announced the voices in solemn and portentous tones,
"has beheld herself in the mirror of eternity, and has passed beyond the changes and corruptions of time."
Teglari felt as if he were sinking into some obscure and terrible fen. He could comprehend nothing of what had befallen Athli, and his own fate was an equally dark and dreadful enigma, beyond the solution of a simple hunter. Now the blossoms had lifted about his shoulders, were laving his arms, his body. Beneath their aberrant alchemy, the transformation continued. A long fur sprang up on the thickening torso. The arms lengthened. They became simian. The hands took on a likeness to the feet. From the neck downward, Teglari differed in no wise from the apish creatures of the garden. In helpless, abject horror, he waited for the completion of the metamorphosis. Then he became aware that a man in somber garments, with eyes and mouth filled with the weariness of strange things, was standing before him. Behind the man were two of the sickle-handed iron automatons. In a somewhat languid voice, the man uttered an unknown word that vibrated in the air with prolonged, mysterious aftertones.
"Blossom, orchid of life."
The circle of craning flowers drew back from Teglari, resuming their former upright positions in a close hedge, and the wiry tendrils were withdrawn from his ankles. Hardly able to comprehend his release, he heard a sound of brazen voices, and knew dimly that the demon heads of the columns had spoken, saying,
"The hunter Teglari has been laved in the nectar of the blossoms of primordial life, and has become in all ways, from the neck downward, even as the beasts that he hunted."
When the chorus ceased, the weary man in somber raiment came nearer and addressed him.
"I, Muad'Dib, had planned to deal with you precisely as I dealt with Mokar and many others. Mokar was the beast that you met in the labyrinth, with new-made fur still sleek and wet from the liquor of the flowers, and you saw some of his predecessors about the palace. However, I find that my whims are not always the same. You, Teglari, unlike the others, shall at least remain a man from the neck upward. You are free to resume your wanderings in the labyrinth, and escape from it if you can. I do not wish to see you again, and my clemency springs from another reason than esteem for your kind. Go now. The maze has many windings which you are yet to traverse."
A great awe was upon Teglari. His native fierceness, his savage volition, were tamed by the enchanter's languid will.
With one backward look of concern and wonder at Athley, he withdrew obediently, crouching like a huge ape. His fur glistening wetly to the three suns, he vanished amid the labyrinth. Mal Dweb, attended by his metal slaves, went over to the figure of Athley, which still regarded the mirror with astonished eyes. "Mong Lut," he said, addressing by name the nearer of the two automatons at his heels. "It has been, as you know, my caprice to eternalize the frail beauty of women. Athley, like the others before her, has explored my ingenuous maze, and has looked into that mirror whose sudden radiance turns the flesh to a stone fairer than marble, and no less enduring. Also, as you know, it has been my whim to turn men into beasts with the copious fluid of certain artificial flowers, so that their outer semblance should conform more strictly to their inner nature. Is it not well, Mong Lunt, that I have done these things? Am I not Mal Dweb, in whom all knowledge and all power resides?"
"Yes, master,"
echoed the automaton.
"You are Mal Dweb, the all-wise, the all-powerful, and it is well that you have done these things."
"However," continued Mal Dweb, "the repetition of even the most remarkable thaumaturgies can grow tiresome after a certain number of times. I do not think that I shall deal again in this fashion with any woman, or deal thus with any man. Is it not well, Mong Lut, that I should vary my sorceries in future? Am I not Mal Dweb, the all-resourceful?"
"Indeed, you are Mal Dweb,"
agreed the automaton.
"And it would no doubt be well for you to diversify your enchantments."
Mal Dweb was not ill-pleased with the answers that the automaton had given. He cared little for converse, other than the iron echoings of his metal servitors, who assented always to all that he said, and spared him the tedium of arguments. And it may have been that there were times when he wearied a little even of this, and preferred the silence of the petrified women, or the muteness of the beasts that could no longer call themselves men. This is the end of The Maze of Mal Dweb by Clark Ashton Smith.